grenade, which of course we believed killed the man.
The Stryker 5 team would kill two more civilians by May 2010. Jeremy Morlock confessed his crimes as part of a plea bargain the next year and was sentenced to 24 years in prison in exchange for testimony against the other four soldiers. Private Holmes pled guilty to the first of the killings and was sentenced to 7 years in prison. The Stryker 5 case was certainly not the first instance of violent misconduct in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. On March 23, 2003, the eve of the Iraq invasion, Sergeant Hassan Akbar killed two of his fellow soldiers and wounded 14 in an attack on a U.S. Army base in Kuwait. Professor Victor Hansen, a former Army JAG officer, led Sergeant Akbar's defense team during his court-martial. Since leaving military service in 2005, Hansen has taught military law and criminal procedure at the New England School of Law in Boston.
On the night of the incidents, he was on guard. He was out on kind of on his own on guard, and while he was out on guard, he got some grenades and he got some ammunition, and he left his post and he went over to another area in the unit and walked through that area. He went opened one tent. He knew these were officer tents of other officers in his unit, and he threw a grenade into one tent and began firing. He struck a couple of people with the weapon with his firing. He went into another tent, I believe, threw a second grenade, fired some more rounds from his rifle, and then he went into a third tent and did the same. He shot and killed one person in that tent, and then another person who was outside of the tents, a captain, he shot him, I believe, two or three times and killed him as well. He was quickly apprehended after that and confined, and then the criminal process against him began. Sergeant Akbar, who was a soldier in the 101st, was the one responsible for initiating the attack. So Sergeant Akbar was a soldier in the 101st Airborne Division. They were at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. He was a combat engineer. He had been in the Army 4 or 5 years by this point. He was a little older. He had graduated from college, just barely. Didn't really have any success finding a job, so he joined the Army right before the beginning of the military operations in Iraq. And the decision was made when the 101st Airborne deployed to Kuwait that Sergeant Akbar would go with the unit and deploy. And more significantly, and frankly more troubling to me, was that he was put in a leadership position. And he just was not capable. He was not competent to be leading other soldiers. He was prosecuted. He ultimately did receive the death penalty, so he's now at Fort Leavenworth on death row.
As with Jeremy Morlock, there were signs that Sergeant Akbar was unfit for armed service. Investigations after the attack revealed the sergeant had a history of behavioral issues before deployment and found that he was even known for violent sleepwalking episodes. Still, the 31-year-old was sent to Kuwait ahead of the Iraq invasion.
In terms of the debate as to whether PTSD or TBI, to what extent those conditions are responsible for a soldier committing murder, I personally, having dealt with a number of these cases, would be reluctant to ascribe an individual's conduct to a brain, to suggest that those things have caused them by themselves to commit violence. No, I think there's some other factors involved than just TBI or PTSD. And it's almost always a personality defect.
In the Stryker 5 and Akbar cases, lack of supervision and screening of soldiers clearly played a significant role. But what about in other instances of military misconduct, such as Abu Ghraib? What role did factors such as training and orders from superior officers play?
So I got a call one day basically from my senior JAG officer, and he said, well, you need to fly to Germany and visit and meet with General Sanchez. He was certainly responsible for directing some of the initial investigations. We've all seen the photos, and they're horrific. I think the feeling that I had like many of my fellow service members, was just a feeling of disbelief. Couldn't believe that this would happen, that our service members would be involved in something like that. It was, I mean, sickening. I mean, that's kind of the overall feeling that many of us felt. At the end of those investigations, there were some certainly very critical findings that found that he and his leadership team had not done everything that they should have done to ensure that these things didn't happen and to clarify what our responsibilities are. One of the most significant, I think, investigative outcomes was the determination that some of the interrogation techniques that had been used in Guantanamo had migrated, it was the term that these investigations used, had migrated to Abu Ghraib. And so the soldiers who were there at Abu Ghraib were using the same kinds or had been told about these investigation techniques at Guantanamo and were using the same kinds of techniques.
Abu Ghraib exposed to the world a shocking image: American soldiers committing acts of torture. As pictures from Abu Ghraib surfaced and details of the U.S. torture program became known, the world and U.S. citizens alike wondered what had led soldiers to commit such acts and whether their leaders had ordered them to do so.
The word was passed down, quote, "The gentlemen, the gloves are coming off," along with a list of torture techniques that was brought over from Guantanamo via Afghanistan. Even though this was rescinded some weeks later, it sent a message. This is the kind of thing that we want to do. There was incredible pressure on people to get intelligence.
Orders such as "the gloves are coming off" suggested that the rules for proper treatment no longer applied. Memos and emails from within the Bush administration directed interrogators to break detainees.
There was a commander in Iraq who, when that message about taking off the gloves happened, he sent a response and said, "Gentlemen, let's take a step back, let's take a breath, and think what we're doing." And he put the orders out: "There will be no abuse in my command," and there was no abuse from what I understand. But that was not what was done in general. What was done was the message sort of was, well, we don't torture, however, do whatever you have to do to get the intelligence, because they were in a situation where they occupied Iraq. It went very smoothly. Within a couple of months, this insurgency developed. They hadn't anticipated it. They were so self-absorbed, it never occurred to them that people in Iraq might not take so kindly to being occupied by Americans. They didn't know what was going on. They were desperate to get intelligence, and they sent down basically the command was, do whatever you have to do.
It was awful news from Afghanistan. A stunning and so far inexplicable mass killing by an American soldier inside a small Afghan village. That soldier acting alone, U.S. officials say, opened fire early today just outside his base in Kandahar province.
Certainly when you see a situation like Sergeant Bales, who had killed 16 people in Afghanistan, anytime you see something like that, I think almost the first thing that comes to mind is something's wrong mentally. How could you otherwise explain what's going on?
In 2002, he was accused of assaulting a girlfriend and was required to undergo anger management. In 2008, he was cited for leaving the scene of an accident. He joined the Army soon after the 9/11 attacks. Over 11 years, he was deployed to war zones four times. He reportedly suffered a traumatic brain injury when his Humvee rolled over.
So clearly, they're under a lot of mental stress. It could be raised to the level of insanity. When you see a situation like this, I mean, I think the natural reaction for anybody is, how could it not be a factor in explaining their behavior. The reality is that these people are put under an enormous amount of stress. If you have a soldier who's deployed and been subjected to combat and the stresses of combat and traumatic brain injury, concussions, those kinds of things, of course, it's going to have some consequences.
Between 300 and 500 unarmed civilians were massacred by American soldiers at My Lai, Vietnam in March 1968. The shock and revulsion from My Lai prompted the U.S. military to re-examine its rules of engagement and battlefield training. Instances of gross misconduct such as Abu Ghraib call into question the high standards put in place after the Vietnam War.
During Vietnam, there was an incident referred to as the My Lai Massacre that occurred towards the end of the Vietnam War, where you had a platoon or a couple of platoons of infantry, American infantry, that assaulted a village and massacred civilians, 400 or 500 civilians, just massacred them in cold blood. And as a result of that and other situations that had occurred during Vietnam, the morale in the force was very low at the end of the Vietnam War. And there was a feeling among the American people that the military was not, you know, was not an honored profession. The reference you often heard at the end of the Vietnam War is that soldiers were referred to as baby killers. And that was directly coming out of that My Lai massacre incident.
Instances of misconduct like these may be the exception. But just as generations will remember My Lai as a defining event in the Vietnam War, events such as Abu Ghraib, Haditha, Bagram, the Stryker 5 killings, and others will always define how the world perceives the U.S. and its role. Misconduct by soldiers is not limited to crimes committed overseas. An outbreak of violent crime and fatal shootings by soldiers from one Colorado combat brigade prompted David Phillips, a reporter, to investigate its source.
It was only one battalion, one group of about 500 guys, that almost all of this violent crime was coming out of. And when I saw that, it was just coming from more or less one specific group, I said, my God, what happened to these guys collectively in their experience, in their deployments to Iraq, in their time coming home that would lead to this? When we looked at what made that unit different, it was pretty stark. They had been deployed to Iraq in 2004 to the worst place in Iraq, a stretch of road between Fallujah and Ramadi. And they had taken casualties at a rate that was four times that of other combat units. And then they came back after a year there, and they were supposed to have about 2.5 years to sort of recharge and reorganize here in the United States. Well, the Iraq War was going so bad that the Army couldn't spare them that time. And so they sent them back to Iraq after only 1 year. Again, they were sent to the worst place in Iraq. This time it had moved to downtown Baghdad. And again, they faced casualties that were several times the normal rate. Now, when these guys started melting down from being in the field facing death daily and watching their friends be maimed or killed, there was really no good plan in place. There was no plan to take care of them, to treat their mental wounds. And so a lot of times, if these guys started losing it, the battalion's solution was, hey, this guy's too dangerous now to be in Iraq, so let's send him back to Colorado Springs.
Courtney Lockhart and Kenneth Eastridge both served in the Fort Carson Lethal Warriors Brigade. Both were convicted of murder after returning from Iraq. In total, 12 soldiers from Lockhart and Eastridge's brigade were arrested for murder or attempted murder after returning from Iraq.
There may be other battalions that have a very similar story to this one, and we just don't know about it. I gotta tell you, the military is not advertising when they have outbreaks of violent crime. There may have been something to do with the culture of this unit that made it particularly susceptible.
Eastridge was convicted for the killing of another 24-year-old veteran who had served with his unit in Iraq. The victim was shot 3 times and left on the side of a road. Eastridge confessed to being an accessory to murder in the case. In 2010, the Army released a study on the health effects of repeated deployment. Research found that soldiers with previous deployments were more than 3 times as likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder and depression. Some soldiers deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq served 3 or 4 tours, sometimes back to back.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions that parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Adolescence is a state which has biological importance, but as per educationalists, psychologists, and sociologists, it also has Islamic importance because that's the time when the legal liability is assumed. Yes, today we're going to discuss about adolescence with our dear guest, Professor Salman Naqvi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University and a researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Oh, well, since we are going to discuss about adolescence, so first of all, we would want to know from you, what is adolescence?
Yes, thank you very much. Just as you mentioned, it is a very sensitive age in the life cycle of a human being. It's the time when he's becoming an adult or she's becoming an adult where certainly biological changes are taking place and also psychological changes are taking place within him or her. So it's the time from the from puberty towards adulthood. And as you said, according to our legal understanding from the Islamic point of view, obligations, religious obligations, start from that very point when a person becomes of age and he reaches or she reaches the age of puberty. And therefore, it is very important from this perspective that he or she has to take care of the religious obligations that are there, and which means one should know those obligations before that age.
Yeah.
And since...
That's what we have been discussing with you in our previous session. We discussed the practical development wherein you said that it's not the age, it's not the puberty when the things, practical laws should be assumed. It's basically before that. One should have necessary knowledge before that so that he's easily able to apply
exactly.
This.
Exactly. Actually, parents have to play a very important role before the age of puberty.
Yeah.
Because actually, if there is a responsibility upon the child to learn about those things, it is basically this responsibility is pointed towards the parents.
Yeah.
That they make sure that he or she starts learning those things before that age. The obligation is therefore shifted towards the parents. After the age of puberty, the responsibility to learn more and develop more further is upon the child,
yeah,
the person who is becoming an adult. But before that, it is basically the responsibility of the parents to ensure that he or she learns those things which are become obligatory the very time, the very day he or she becomes achieves that level of puberty, and those signs which are there for ascertaining the time of puberty come out in the body, and one realizes that he or she has become an adult or of legal age. Those responsibilities start spontaneously.
Yeah.
So therefore, he or she has to be prepared for that.
Prepared from the very beginning. We'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned for us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I am Zainab with Professor Naqavi, and we're discussing about adolescence. Well, Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, you said that the practical laws of Islam should not be actually observed after the age of puberty. One should have necessary information, teenagers should have necessary information before the age of puberty.
Exactly. Basically, again, the practical laws, the practical aspects of the human life, are based on the worldview that a person develops,
yeah,
before carrying out those practices. So the ideological development of the child is very important before he or she becomes an adult, and those responsibilities are upon him or her. Those responsibilities have to be carried out, some of them, if they are of the ritualistic type, where the niya is the intention, the pure intention, it has to be there.
Yeah.
For example, for praying, for offering, for observing the fast.
Yeah.
These obligations have to be carried out with a sincere intention, the niya. And this niya can only be developed if the person has a proper understanding of the world, of the purpose of life. Why does it become obligatory for him or her to pray? This why has to come before that. He or she must realize that she has been or he has been created by God Almighty for a certain purpose. He or she should realize that. And therefore, there should be a certain level of ideological development before one is able to carry out the practical aspects of religion.
Yeah, as Imam Baqir al-Azam puts it, that if a person does not know why he is praying, he's as if he's going on a path without knowing the destination, as if he's just moving,
exactly,
on the road without just.
I mean, when we talk about
goal,
the niyya, when we say it is wajib to have niyya, what does that mean? I mean, niyya is not something you write on the wall and say, look, I am praying for this sake. Or
yeah,
you write on a piece of paper, or you pronounce it in using words, or even it does not have to pass through your mind that you are praying for the sake of Allah Almighty. No, your very mindset is the moment you get up and you carry out wudu and you prepare yourself for the obligatory prayers. The intention for which you with which you are getting up is the niyyah.
Yeah.
And where does this niyyah come from? It has a background in your mind. And that background has to be developed before that action is called carried out. Yes, before it is very much emphasized for the parents, upon the parents, that a child should start praying, for example, at the age of 7, when he has not become a person who is of the legal age. But he has to be given training for that. He has to be prepared for the time it becomes obligatory.
Yeah.
At that time, the child will carry out those deeds by imitating their parents.
Yeah.
He or she will see or his or her parents praying and following in line with them, and they would be trying to influence the child or to motivate the child to come along and pray with them.
Yes.
There the worldview is not important, but gradually it has to be developed.
It starts with imitation, and then worldview gets developed automatically. We'll discuss more on the topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "When a child becomes intellectually mature and is able to recite parts of the Quran, he should be taught how to pray."
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi, and we're discussing about adolescents. Professor Naqavi, before the break, we said that a child should start praying and observing practical laws of Islam from the very early age, not just when he reaches adolescence. Just because he starts with the imitation when he's very young, and then automatically a worldview is developed within him. He starts using his cognitive skills to think, to ponder, to develop that particular worldview.
Exactly. I mean, it's not automatic. It has to be developed in the school, at the home, in the course of studies. I mean, today the important thing is when we talk about, for example, we are talking about praying, and the Quran says that you should offer your prayers, you should establish your prayers, praying defends a person from doing bad things. Inna salata tanha anil fahshai wal munkar. Wala dhikrullah akbar. What is the importance of prayers? It is the remembrance of God. The most important thing is the remembrance of God. Praying is for the sake of remembering God.
Okay.
And this attitude and this mindset that we are always aware of the presence of Allah Almighty. Rather, we observe ourselves to be in His majestic presence. We are all the time thinking that we are before Him, and we have to observe the boundaries that Allah Almighty has created or legislated for us. This understanding has to be developed from the beginning of one's childhood. It cannot come at the time of puberty. It has to be there before. And you would say a child cannot perceive those things very easily. No, why not? Actually, even within the Islamic teachings and texts, we have a stage which is before puberty.
All right.
And for example, it is asked if a child is of, for example, 10 years of age, 11 of years of age, and he does not, especially a boy, he's not at the age of puberty where it becomes obligatory for him to, for ladies to observe hijab in front of that boy. Even then, it is emphasized that ladies, women should observe hijab in front of a person or child who is maybe 10 to 11 years old, not at the age of puberty, but because he is at an age where he can differentiate between
good and bad.
He knows things. And in today's world, with the social media which we have, the information revolution which we have, children of a very tender age know many things which we
don't know.
We didn't know or don't know even now.
Yeah.
Therefore, the development of the human brain is much faster today than it was previously.
Yeah.
So, which means that we cannot forget to, we cannot say, look, we can't train our children or educate them to become, to have that mindset. No, that age is very important, that a child is brought up in such a way that he becomes to realize that he is living in a world created by Allah Almighty, and he is continuously in the presence of Allah Almighty. Either you would say we can see him through his signs, or if we cannot see him, even he is watching upon us. And with that attitude, we have to pray.
Yeah.
So that is important. And this attitude, this understanding has to develop from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And therefore, if that is created, so when a person becomes to the age of puberty and becomes an adolescent, he is already prepared for that, that he will pray with sincerity.
Yes.
He will carry out his other obligations with a sincerity of purpose and a sincerity of action.
Yeah. So the more early we actually start things, the more early we'll get the fruits. Thank you so much, Professor Nakavi, for being with us. Thank you so much to our listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. the inception, the nature of the struggle, and the incentive for revolution were all different. There is no doubt that it was a divine gift and blessing from the unseen granted by Allah the Almighty to this oppressed and pillaged nation. Islam and Islamic government is a divine phenomenon, the implementation of which guarantees the happiness of its followers in this world and the hereafter in the best possible way, and has the potential to eliminate tyranny, corruption, and transgression, and leading humankind to its ultimate desired goal.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to another episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. Well, in this program, we try to have a profound reading of Imam Khomeini's precious words and speeches about the subject of knowledge and the knowledgeable. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, says that knowledge will acquire its fundamental function when it is pursued throughout one's life. Therefore, it should be planned in such a way as to be present throughout man's existence. Considering this part of speech, one can interpret that knowledge in itself doesn't help a person. In order to be useful, it must be accompanied by both insight and action. Imam Rida alayhi salam says that the weapons to consume negligence are knowledge and insight. We can infer that when knowledge accompanies insight, it will elevate a cheap and decadent soul, and on the other hand, negligence will degrade many respectable souls. Another important requirement for knowledge in order to be beneficial is action. Imam Ali alayhi salam said in this regard that, for sure, a knowledgeable person who acts against his knowledge is just like an ignorant who will never leave his negligence. The knowledgeable is even in a worse condition because the reason for him is greater, the regret is long-lasting, and he is more to be blamed in front of God. Okay, welcome back. You're listening to Spring of the Truth, and we were talking about the most important components of knowledge, which are insight and action. Well, in this speech, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is aptly referring to these narrations and making us, as his audience, aware of the danger of learning knowledge alone, and then feeling proud of ourselves in the vain thoughts of success. Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is in fact warning us that such knowledge, if not harmful, is quite useless and absurd. Hence, in order to make knowledge fruitful, one must insert it within his blood and heart, and not just recite it with his or her tongue.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Aperture.
Situated in a relatively remote desert at the Negev Nuclear Research Center, the Dimona reactor is a heavy water-moderated natural uranium-fueled reactor. Most independent analysts believe that in the mid-1970s, Israel upgraded the installation to generate between 70 and 150 megawatts. Now, that output makes it not only the region's largest reactor, but the sole evident producer of plutonium and tritium for nuclear weapons. And although Israel neither confirms nor denies its atomic arsenal, experts believe that it's been a nuclear-armed regime now for several decades. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. While the Zionist regime of Israel has maintained its decades-long policy of deliberate ambiguity about its weapons of mass destruction, its deadly arsenal is not the only danger threatening lives. The very existence of the Dimona is a terror haunting Jordan and Israel's other neighboring countries. A higher rate of cancer and the constant fear of possible malfunctions at the reactor are some of the worries that locals must deal with on a daily basis. And the Israelis are aware of the possibility of a meltdown at the Dimona reactor, a meltdown that would affect an area reaching Cyprus and the entire neighboring region. What makes these concerns even more pressing are satellite images of the Dimona reactor, which show that its walls have cracks which could cut its life by half. Join us this week's documentary exploring the threats that Dimona is posing on its neighbors.
Let's talk about Dimona. Many people say, well, nobody knows.
You see, I blush, you say Dimona and I blush. We're not supposed to talk about Dimona. But
why?
Go ahead. Because it's a taboo. It's a taboo, it's a secret.
Negev Desert, south of Israel. This mysterious complex away from the public eye employs thousands of people, all sworn to secrecy. When its existence was discovered, Israel said it was a textile factory, never admitting its true purpose, making plutonium for atomic bombs. We need answers. We go to meet one of the few people in Israel that knows what is going on inside Dimona.
We are dealing with this element of weapons of mass destruction, meaning nuclear, chemical, and biological. We're the only NGO dealing with this right now in Israel. When you believe that these are the weapons that keeps you safe, when this is the common belief, then the question raised, are we the next country to use them? Israel is a nuclear armed state, chemical armed state, and biological armed state. Nuclear weapon is not a weapon that aimed at an army. It's a weapon that destroys a city. Are we willing to destroy any city in the Middle East? Mothers, children, fathers, citizens, not soldiers.
Want to know more about the most secretive nuclear program in the world?
Just transmitted at the request of the.
Is the Israeli nuclear plant at Dimona poisoning and threatening the lives of millions throughout the Middle East? From Tel Aviv, we go south. Our destination, Dimona. Approaching a nuclear plant is a high risk. The highway splices through the heat and sand of the Negev Desert. A barbed wire fence edges the road. Signs posted every few hundred meters warn drivers not to stop their vehicles under any circumstances.
They have cameras, they will see.
This is a military zone.
They said don't go off the road. Military zone, no photography.
Finally, we can have a distant look at one of the world's most secret facilities. an exclusive view of a secret Israel is hiding since the 1960s. Dimona Nuclear Plant.
That's the gate. Go inside.
Only a few people in the world can say they know each corner of Dimona Nuclear Plant. All of them are sworn to secrecy. But there is someone that knows exactly how the building looks like.
It was a secret competition with the design of the civic center of a new atomic research center that was to be built in Dimona, in the south part of Israel. For security reasons, we couldn't call it a big center of research, it was called a civic center in the Negev. In the 60s, it wasn't such big news to have a textile factory in Dimona. So if you built something large in Dimona, you could very easily say, you see, this is a textile factory. Only that this textile factory had a dome and very... wasn't typical of textile, but it wasn't seen from the road. It was kind of an agreed quietness. I have the photograph. While the project was being built, not when it was occupied. Then at that time, the security eye was not that strong. So I took the photographs. Later, many years afterwards, I all of a sudden got several photos from an unknown source, but with a stamp of the censorship. So I understood that somebody from the site sent me photos that were taken there. There's a sign that I can open my small portfolio and make it public. The courtyard of the main building, from the other side, looking towards the entrance. The detail of the stairs leading from the to the roof. You can have a roof cover, as you see here. You can go up to the roof under cover. There's a kind of...
This message is transmitted at the request of the United States
when
Office
President
of
Kennedy
Defense.
Took office, he knew from a CIA secret report that Israel was developing a nuclear program in the Negev. At the beginning of January 1961, Kennedy met the Israeli ambassador in Washington and expressed that the USA wanted to inspect Dimona to be sure about its purposes. Israel accepted, but under one condition, if it was done on a secret basis. For 5 months, the visit of the American inspectors to Dimona nuclear plant was postponed several times by Israel. Finally, an ultimatum from USA was accepted. Two American scientists were allowed to visit Dimona in May 1961. Israel imposed several rules on the American inspectors. They were not allowed to take any pictures or issue any comments about Dimona. When the inspectors finally entered the plant, they were misled. They were shown a fake control room on the ground floor. 12th of January 1961, the aim of the building built in the Negev was clear. In a high-level meeting between President Eisenhower and his staff, the U.S. Secretary of Defense informs the president based on intelligence findings, Israel was lying, and Dimona was not for peaceful purposes. unaware of the six floors below where the plutonium was made. In search of answers, we travel to Berlin in Germany. Here we are going to meet Xantha Hall. She is an expert in nuclear weapons and the director of International Positions for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Xantha Hall is also the coordinator of the European Parliament Commission Against Nuclear Proliferation.
The Israel Atomic Energy Commission is one of the most secret institutions in the world. It's responsible for Dimona, its chairman is Netanyahu, but it's not even officially recognized as existing. All the other nuclear plants in the world are monitored by the Atomic Energy Agency, but not the ones in Israel. So we think it's about time that Dimona was also monitored. The one thing that needs to happen is that an independent body like the IAEA would go into Dimona and find out what is going on there, what is the state of the substance of the building, is the containment of the nuclear reactor still intact, what are they doing about cooling, where is the nuclear waste being stored, how is it being stored, and all these questions, they need to be answered. We need some transparency.
Israel has not ratified the Non-Proliferation Treaty, a way of avoiding inspections to its nuclear sites.
First of all, we are not obliged. We are not part of the treaties. We never signed the treaties, so we don't oblige. We never said we won't. That's one thing. Second thing is the US. And the third thing is the Holocaust.
How?
Guilt. Do you see Germany? Germany sold us the submarines. The US, they let us steal uranium. You go to the UN, to the NPT, to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and you hear the US delegation reading their statements, and when they talk about Israel, you see paragraphs that you know from the language was written by Israelis.
So Israel has a special treatment?
Yes, we're a special case.
Yoshi Melman is known as an investigative journalist, specialized in intelligence and strategic affairs. He was described by WikiLeaks as an information mule who has exchanged tips with the Mossad. But in 2009, Melman uncovered a terrible secret about Dimona. Workers at the nuclear reactor facility were made to volunteer to drink uranium in 1998 as part of an experiment.
The workers themselves already cannot say anything. They have so many contracts saying that they cannot say. The question is the family. So usually in order for them to get compensation, the families also have to say they will not sue, they will not say, they will not speak to the media and so on. So we know only when they have settlements, when the court say settlement, that they give some money, but we don't know how much usually, and we don't know how many, and we don't know what conditions. And also their doctors are only doctors that work with the commission.
I mean, if you only have a nuclear reactor that is making energy like Chernobyl or Fukushima, that's just one thing. You have lots of possibilities for accidents, but if you've got added to that, you've got uranium enrichment, you've got plutonium reprocessing, and you have actually the making of the warheads, then you have, you know, many more possibilities. Have there already been accidents? There's been some rumors and speculation that in 1966 there was a criticality accident at Dimona. We don't know what's been happening in that plant, and actually it seems that there's probably more secrecy than there was in the Soviet Union, because quite quickly after the Chernobyl accident it was actually said that there had been the accident. So I think Israel is more better to compare on the level of secrecy about a nuclear program with perhaps North Korea, because we know nothing about their program either. We do know that they have one, and at least North Korea is making claims that it has nuclear weapons, whereas Israel is pretending that it doesn't. So I'm not trying to say that there will be worse or better, but there are many more possibilities, so the risk is definitely higher.
Our next stop in search of answers about the Israeli nuclear program and its secrets is a Palestinian village. Dahria, very close to Dimona, and a military field where Israel might be burying nuclear waste from Dimona. In Dahria, a Palestinian doctor struggles to keep Dimona's victims alive. Cesium is not present in nature and can only be found in areas where a nuclear disaster or test takes place.
We know how cesium works on the body because of Chernobyl and Fukushima. Both of those accidents showed us a lot of about how cesium actually affects human health, and that there are claims that there has been a study that has found cesium in the region, and cesium is an indication that something has happened with a nuclear activity. It most likely would be, depending on the amount of it, would be from a nuclear accident, or it could be from leaking radioactive waste.
In some areas of Palestine, the presence of cesium is at the same levels as in Chernobyl or Fukushima, places where the worst nuclear accidents took place.
It's a radioactive isotope. It has a half-life of 30.2 years, and it acts like potassium or like salt. It's water soluble, so it can spread very quickly through the body, and it tends to concentrate then in muscle tissue. And you also have muscles in certain organs like heart and stomach and intestines, so that's where often cesium will end up, and at that point it starts then to mutate the cells within those muscles, and you end up with cancer of the colon, cancer of the stomach, of the lungs sometimes, and it can lead to heart disruption.
There are many rumors about where they bury the waste, but my, and not just my, estimations are that all the materials are buried in the area surrounding the reactor, and the reason is that these materials are secret. They don't want people to go and take land samples or go with Geiger.
The Geiger counter is an electronic device that measures the level of radioactivity. These devices are allowed for use everywhere in the world. It is sold everywhere, even online, but not in Israel. Despite claiming to be democratic, Israelis cannot buy a Geiger counter inside Israel.
One of the major problems that we have, again, it goes back to the secrecy problem, is that we can't even measure the amount of radiation in the area, because that's not allowed. And the Israeli law even says that if you take a Geiger counter into the area around Dimona and measure the radioactivity, you could be then sentenced to 15 years in prison. So nobody's going to do that. I know people even thought about doing it, but they didn't. It's certainly very risky to try to do any research on this at all, which is why number one problem is to get rid of the secrecy.
What is the security of Israel, and why the security of Israel is so different than the security of the people that live in Israel? And we hear rumors about buildings where the levels of cancer is unbelievable. And when we wanted to ask doctors, we also didn't get any answers. And one funny or sad answer we got was that we cannot measure the amount of cancer, radiation-related cancer in Israel, because we had so many people coming from Chernobyl, from Kiev, and that changed the numbers. So that was one answer we got. And of course, this is not a serious answer. People in Dimona are not rich, most of them. This is, if they were rich people, they wouldn't